least a few hours of relief from all the heat. It's been pretty rough. So anyway, it's good to be here with you. My wife apologizes for not coming, but we got back from our vacation in Houston at 2:30 on Wednesday morning. So we went to bed late. She got up early and went to work, and so she just said, I can't do it. So she apologizes for that, but she'll look forward to being with you next time. We, as far as announcements are concerned, we will have next Sabbath, July the 17th, we will have services here in Prestonsburg at 11 a.m. I know we were supposed to have finger foods and Bible study today, but I just thought it would be better for me to have changed things around a little bit and be present today and talk about a few things that I think are important as in the time that we're in. So hopefully, I don't think anybody's going to the Bahamas or the Caribbean for the feast, so that's the only announcement we had in regard to the feast. We're looking forward to the feast in Portugal, and we'll see how that goes, depending on whether Portugal still exists by the time we go, with the instability in that part of the world with the euro and all of that kind of thing. It is kind of good because the euro is down in value, which means our dollar goes further, so hopefully it'll last at least until we go there. So things are changing in the world, and it's something that, with the world changing, it is part of what I'm going to speak about today. As Christians, we have high expectations. You know, when you become a Christian, you have high expectations, because as you become a part of the Church of God, you realize that this is God's church, and you are a part of that church that is God's and which belongs to Him. We know the church is the body of Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ is the head of the church. He's our advocate. He's our high priest. And it's God's great plan to bring many sons to glory. And we know that those people who make up God's church, God's Spirit dwells in them. And it's what separates us from the world. And it is God's Spirit is the way that God works in each and every one of us, the way that Christ works in our lives. As we look at the church, we should see the fruits of God's Spirit. All those good things that are mentioned in Galatians chapter 5, verse 22, should be found among the people of God. And as Christ told His disciples before His death, He said, you will know the people of God by their fruits. You will know them because they have love for one another. And the church, as it is in the world, should be a place that people can look to and see the bright light of God's way of life shining. That's the way it should be. And I think Acts chapter 2 gives us a fair description of what the church should be. This is the ideal state of the church and the way it should be. And Acts chapter 2, beginning in verse 40. Acts chapter 2, verse 40, Peter has given his Pentecost sermon to the crowd gathered there in the temple on the day of Pentecost. And he goes on here in verse 40 to say, "And with many other words, he testified and exhorted them, saying, Be saved from this perverse generation." You know, we live in a perverse generation. We live in a perverse world. You look at what, as you look at the world and the things that we are accepting, you know, we keep moving the ball down the field to accept more and more, and the outcome of all of that acceptance is certainly not a good thing. Verse 41 says, "Then those who gladly received His word were baptized." They gladly received the word of God, and they were baptized. Their sins were washed away, and they received God's Spirit. And that day, about 3,000 souls were added to them. You know, how wonderful it would be to see 3,000 individuals added to the church. We'd be happy with three. We'd be happy with one. You know, interestingly, this week I got a call from the chaplain at the prison in Inez, Kentucky. And it was unusual. He had called several different times while I was on vacation, so I just could get back to him once I got back. And he explained to me what they want is for, and I'm wondering, the United Church of God, why pick us? You know, But anyway, he asked, they want to have a Sabbatarian service twice a month at the prison. And I said, well, how many people would be interested in that? And he said, well, actually about 75, which I'm like, really? So anyway, so I'm thinking about, okay, how can I work this out? So you never know what doors God will open. And, if God opens the door, then maybe you should find a way to go through it. So I'm thinking, okay, how do I do this? So anyway, you might pray about that, because that is something significant that, people in prison are just like all of us. They happen to have broken the law in some way, shape, or form, and they are in prison, and Christ didn't come to heal the healthy. He came to heal the sick, and that building is filled with, those buildings are filled with those who are quite unhealthy for varying reasons. But anyway, they were baptized. 3,000 souls were added to them. Verse 42, and they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, in the breaking of bread and in prayers. So the church begins with a bang. It's exciting. People are enthusiastic about it. Look at God's truth is unfolding here. We're a part of something magnificent that is working out. The promise of the Messiah has been fulfilled, and we are all part of it. Verse 43, then fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done through the apostles. So it was clear to them this was where God was working, and they were a part of where God was working. Verse 44, now all who believed were together and had all things in common. So they were cooperative. They were working together. Some people say this is talking about being communist. It isn't. It's a matter of the circumstances at the time. But they did, because of the circumstances, they needed to share and help things to work out, because you had people that didn't live there and they needed help. They needed support, and they were all willing to do that. Verse 45, and sold their possessions and goods and divided them among all, as anyone had need. So continuing with one accord in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. That's what I would expect the church to be that way. And as I go back 15 years ago, I think the church was that way. However, it doesn't always remain that way, unfortunately. And as you look at the history, even of the New Testament, you find that this was not the case. By the time you come to the, after the deaths of Peter and Paul were killed, and all the apostles were dead about that time, and the only apostle remaining, somewhere between 90 and 100 A.D., was the Apostle John. And as the Apostle John writes, you can see the church is under stress. You can see a lack of respect for John, and you see problems in the church at that time. So as we come forward to our time and we see problems in the church, we should not be surprised. It doesn't make it pleasant, but it's the way that it is. And should we be surprised if the church faces challenges? One thing that I thought about as I was preparing for the sermon is a point made in Psalm 23, which it talks about walking through the valley of the shadow of death. In Psalm 23, verse 4, the Lord is our shepherd, but He tells us in that psalm that as we make our journey along, as we are walking with the shepherd, it says we will go through the valley of the shadow of death at some point and in some way. And we may, you may go down and you may come up and you may go down again. So you're going to pass through these places as you're on your journey to eternal life. And I would say at this, for all of you, it's peaceful here. And that's a good thing. So I don't think anybody's all stirred up and all shook up or anything like that. But that's not the way it is everywhere. So I'm for that reason, I'm discussing this. And I think it's something to be aware of. It's not something to get all panicked about. It's just, sadly, the way life is in God's church. And there are reasons why that is the case. So as you think about walking through the valley of the shadow of death, you kind of think about that imagery, and you think about you're in this valley and you're walking along, and a shadow comes over you. If you happen to be, I take my dog for a walk in the park, And occasionally there are hawks in this park, and you'll see my dog, he's about 30 pounds, but you'll see the hawk fly over and think about it. Now, can I get that 30-pound dog off the ground and take him where I can eat him, you know? And so I see him flying over, and my dog's oblivious, but I see the hawk coming, and you see the shadow of the hawk back there sometimes. And it's kind of like that. There's something threatening down as you're down this valley, and that shadow comes over you. So the point is that, you know, you have a threat, the threat of death. And the question is, how do we survive the valley of the shadow of death? How do you survive that? How do you make sure that you get through the valley and beyond that shadow and where we need to go? So the title of my sermon is Surviving the Valley of the Shadow of Death. Now, should we be surprised that this condition does rear its ugly head occasionally? We shouldn't. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. It says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood." And when he says we, he's talking about Christians. You know, as we face adversaries in the physical world, human beings who are our adversaries, wherever they may come from, he's telling us that, yes, we're facing human beings, but the influence behind them, the motivating factor behind them, isn't just the flesh and blood. Satan is our adversary, and Satan uses human instruments to accomplish his purpose. So we're not wrestling just against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age. You see, Satan is still the ruler of this world. And there are demons who are serving as princes, as rulers over this age. They have not been removed from their positions at this time. They will be removed, and we will replace them. That's why Christians are so hated, because we are their replacements. That's why they are so adversarial, because Satan is against what God is working out. And the demons have joined him in that enterprise to undermine and destroy God and his work. So they are the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places. So we face spiritual adversaries, and they are real, and they are dedicated to our destruction. As I look at the world as a whole, it just seems like the lunatics are running the asylum today, and the decisions that are being made are crazy, because the outcome, you know, you think, okay, this has never worked. Why is it going to work for us? It's never worked. And interestingly, I'm reading a book called The Road to Serfdom. And one of the key points that the author of that book is making is that if you follow the policies that we're following, the ultimate end of those policies is totalitarianism. It led to Hitler and Mussolini and Stalin, and you follow that course, and that is the ultimate outcome. So we are on a course that is ultimately going to lead to the beast and the false prophet, the ultimate totalitarian state. A state dedicated to the destruction of the people of God. They will be, you know, Satan's instrument. We're on that course, unfortunately. So we have to realize that as we face adversaries and challenges, that we're facing Satan and the demons. It is, and he is doing his best to destroy us, to undermine us. And he never stops working. You know, he never gets tired. We do. Let's go to Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. And you know, I didn't quote there in Ephesians 6 where it talks about put on the whole army of God. The point is, yes, we wrestle against them, but God reassures you, look, when you're going to take the field against Satan every day as a Christian. He said, "You've got my armor, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. You will be able to stand, and you will be able to be victorious. But But I'm just citing that point in order to emphasize that we do face challenges, and Satan is at the root of it. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, it says, "Be sober, be vigilant." So we need to be awake, we need to be vigilant, we need to be looking around. "Because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." So Satan is like a lion, and he is in the bushes, he's there sneaking up, he's always looking for where you're vulnerable. While we were in Houston, we put ourselves in jeopardy because we went to a state park there that has alligators in it. And so you can walk through the park and you can look out into the water there on either side of the road, and you can see alligators down there. And in fact, as we were walking along, there was one up pretty close to the road. So we were glad we didn't bring my son-in-law's dog, because that alligator probably would have moved closer to the dog. So anyway, but you had to keep your eyes open, because they're on the banks and different things, and if you get too close, they'll make a move and seek to devour you. And so you have to be alert. And Satan is just such a being. He is constantly seeking whom he may devour. And keep in mind that word devour, because we'll come back to it. It says in verse 9, resist him. You have to resist him. And how do you resist him? You resist him by being steadfast in the faith. You have to know what you believe and hold to it. Knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. You see, Satan has attacked the people of God for 2,000 years, really for six. I mean, he attacked Adam and Eve in the garden. And he's continued his attack because he wants to undermine human beings and to prevent them from ultimately ending up in the family of God. So, as we face challenges as Christians, we shouldn't be surprised, because that's what the people of God have faced for thousands of years. It says in verse 10, "But may the God of all grace, who called us," he called us, "to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you." Yes, we go through suffering, but you have to keep in mind you've been called. And yes, we all may suffer at times, but we are being perfected, we are being established, we are being strengthened, we are being settled and prepared for something greater. And what we go through, even if it's self-induced sometimes, is all part of our being prepared for the kingdom of God. So just as you face challenges on many levels, the challenges we face are stimulated by Satan. Satan is behind them. And Satan uses external threats as one way of undermining us. He seeks to persecute us through the religious and civil authorities. Now, interestingly, I'm thinking about, okay, if I go in and I begin having a Sabbath service on a Saturday afternoon or whenever we might do it in Inez, how long will that last? You see, you have to preach the truth. Now, just because they meet on the Sabbath doesn't mean they're going to agree with you. So it may last a long time. It may last a short time. It just depends. You don't go in to deliberately be offensive, but the truth is offensive to some people because they don't believe the same way you do. So anyway, that's religious and civil authorities can bring pressure to bear on us. And for instance, a man who was teaching about Catholic doctrine at the University of Illinois was dismissed because he basically stated that he agreed with the Catholic position that homosexuality is wrong. And that was seen as hate speech, and he's out. However, interestingly, in the society in which we live, to talk about killing white people and all of that, all the crackers, is not considered hate speech. Just something interesting in our society, unfortunately. You know, sometimes we can face challenges from our non-member family. You know, our family's not a part of the church, but they can make life kind of hard. And you know, they're not thinking, well, I'm doing this on Satan's behalf. They're doing what they think is right, and they think you're crazy for your religious beliefs and what you're doing. You're meeting when? And you're driving where? Are you out of your mind? That's how it is. But they can put some pressure on you. Our employers can put pressure on us, can't they? You know, they can be used as instruments. You know, you want your job? You'll be here Saturday. Or you'll be here on Friday night. And when jobs are hard to come by, that's a pretty tough challenge, isn't it? And Satan has created a world which tempts us to sin. He tempts us to sin. And offers us lots and lots of temptations. And he gives you lots of things that look awfully enticing. One thing that you come to realize is the longer you live, the less enticing it is. Sometimes you see how empty some of the people are that you once thought highly of, you know, as you come to see things more clearly as you mature in life. And many of the threats that come from outside are very straightforward. And we would expect them. We would expect them. It's just, hey, it just comes with the territory. And we aren't surprised by that. And we should never minimize those threats because they are real threats to all of us. But we expect them, but we have to realize that those threats can undermine our opportunity for eternal life. The threats that we have the greatest challenge with are internal threats. Internal, that is, threats that are found within a place that we would consider to be safe. That we would consider to be sure and certain. Those are what I'm designating as internal threats. We wouldn't expect them from on that front. I mean, when we had the challenges that we had in the mid-90s, we didn't expect the threat to come from inside, but that's exactly where it came from. And it caused great destruction. So Satan's pretty smart, and if it worked once, he'll use it again. And he'll use different avenues. And we don't expect threats internally because, we are a part of the Church of God. And this should be a safe haven for the people of God. A place that's safe, that's sure, that's certain. And yes, there may be chaos out here, but we should all be safe in here, shouldn't we? But unfortunately, that's not always the case. That's not always the case. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. And Christ here is near the temple, and they had gone out from the temple complex, and the temple complex was a magnificent place that was being reconstructed by Herod, and the reconstruction had made progress, but it wasn't complete yet. And it really wasn't complete until almost the time when it was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. So it actually went on, the construction went on for about 30 more years. And it was still not complete, and it was finally completed and then destroyed. But it was a beautiful complex. It's up on top of this mountain, and wherever you came from, you would see this magnificent temple complex there on top of the hill. And, with the various the stone and other things that it was built with, it was a magnificent place. But Christ says here, and so they were coming out of the temple, and his disciples were duly impressed with the temple complex and pointed out the magnificent buildings there. And then in verse 2, Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." He said something that was astounding to them, that this magnificent complex, that all this time and effort and money would be destroyed. And so he told them that. They were all, their mouths were probably agape as a result of what Christ said. And then in verse 3 it says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" So when's this all going to work out? When is this going to play out? Is what they wanted to know. So Christ responds to them. He begins answering their questions. And he says to them in verse 4, "Take heed that no one deceives you." No one deceives you. Satan is a deceiver, and he uses human beings to deceive. You know, he talks about Satan's representatives coming as angels of light. They come and they appear to be righteous. They appear to be preaching what is religious or sounds true. And he said, "Take heed that no one deceives you." That's why, you know, it says if they don't adhere to and speak to the law and the testimony. So if you know the law and the testimony, you know what God's truth is. You can't be deceived. But you've got to know it. You can't be in doubt of it. You have to be sure of it. So you can always measure what somebody's telling you against that. "Take heed that no one deceives you." Verse 5, "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." They will come as Christ representatives, and it says they will deceive many. Not a few, but many. So, deception is very much a part of Satan's plan, and he's been quite good at it. And he has deceived lots and lots of people in various ways. You know, in my years in the church, I've seen it happen repeatedly. And it will continue to happen. Then he goes on and he says, "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars." We certainly hear that today. "See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." But you can see that as you look at the stage as it's being set up now, I think we're moving to the end of things. We have the ability to destroy ourselves, which we've not had until about the last 50 years. We can wipe out everything on the earth. Couldn't do that prior to then. It takes a lot of time and effort to kill everybody with bows and arrows or spears or swords. And usually diseases may kill a lot of people, but they didn't get everybody. But we've got all sorts of things, all various ways we can just wipe ourselves out. So he goes on to say, "For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places." We see all these things. All these are the beginning of sorrows. You know, these things have happened down throughout man's history. However, at the end of the age, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which are specific references to the things that are laid out here, they're going to ride herd over the world in a very intense way that the world has not experienced before. False religion, war following on its heels, famine, and pestilence. Especially virulent forms of those things. "All these are the beginning of sorrows." Verse 9, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation." Who's going to be delivered up to tribulation? The world, and most especially the people of God. "And they will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake." Hated because of what you believe. And who most fundamentally hates what you believe? Satan does. It says, then, as this is all unfolding, this time of tribulation, it says, "And then many will be offended." They will be offended. Offended by what? Can be a variety of things. And as a result of those offenses, they will betray one another. That means somebody that you expected to be loyal will betray you. They will betray one another and will hate one another. How could you arrive at that point where you would betray a brother or you could hate a brother or a sister in Christ? It says, "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many." And this is the verse that, to me, is important now. It says, "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. What we have to realize is that how is it that love will wax cold? Well, because of lawlessness. And what is lawlessness? Lawlessness is sin. Sin is abounding where it should not abound. And that is in the body of Christ. And when lawlessness abounds in the church of God, what is the result? What is the result? It diminishes, it causes love, outgoing concern to wax cold. As people don't act like Christians and don't treat each other as Christians, it undermines people. It destroys them. Because sometimes we lose perspective as people don't treat each other the way that they should. And what happens is people stop loving one another. Love waxes cold. So, the thing that we have to realize here is that, when lawlessness abounds, and what happens is, in the way that, in my opinion, things are unfolding today in the church is, people have come to various hardened positions. And as a result of their hardened positions, they believe that they can malign you or they can malign me, and they're justified in doing so. How can you arrive at that? And so you convince yourself that I am justified in saying something that undermines or besmirches another. And what happens is you get a war of words going on, and it is a war. So, and you know, like I said, I'm not saying this in order to stir everybody up. I'm just telling you my observation of something that is taking place in the church. Now, and the thing is, and the sad, you know, in as we had things unfold 15 years ago, the issue was heresy. That was the issue. Okay, people were teaching you that the Trinity is valid. People were teaching you don't have to keep the Sabbath, you don't have to keep the commandments. Okay, that's pretty obvious. And frankly, if you're teaching that, then we should point that out. That's not right. And you have to make a stand against that. But even then, you don't have to be nasty about it. You can say, you're wrong. I don't agree with you. I don't have to impugn you, but I will attack your teaching. But the situation as it exists today is a matter of administration. So, you know, as you fight over something, is administration something we should fight over? Not really. And maybe I don't agree with the way you want to do it, but as long as it's not sin, let's do it. You know, there's no reason to fight over it. But people can. And you can basically get everybody worked up in agreeing with your position and taking sides. And that's what's taken place, unfortunately. And that's not the way that it should be. It's not the way that it should be at all. Let's go to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. Let's look at verses 13 and 14. Now this is describing the way the church should be. Galatians 5, verses 13 and 14. It says here, "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty." You've been called out of bondage to sin. And you've been called and given the opportunity to keep the law of God, to practice God's way of life, which is liberty. That's what we've been called to freedom. So we've been given liberty, and we are to act in a liberated way, which is in keeping with God, in keeping God's law. It says, "Only do not use your liberty as an opportunity for the flesh." You know, you've been given freedom, your sins have been forgiven, but don't use your liberty to go back to living carnally. And don't go back to living a fleshly way. But through love, serve one another. You are to love one another. And through love, you are to serve one another. Verse 14, for all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's how we're to live. Loving your neighbor as yourself. And as you really look at that, it doesn't say, well, I don't like him. You know, he doesn't like me. That doesn't matter. God said you should love your neighbor as yourself. That's how we are to live. And that's a choice. That is a choice. But then he makes an interesting point in verse 15, and it brings us back to the quote I had from Peter. It says, but if you bite and devour one another, you bite and devour one another. Beware lest you be consumed by one another. Now, as you think about biting and devouring, where does that come from? Where does that come from? That's not God leading you to that. That's Satan, the one who seeks whom he may devour. And he's more than happy to enlist you and me and anybody else he can get onto his team to start biting and devouring each other. So, you know, whenever you're if you are attacking others, you're biting and devouring them, and obviously that's something that we've not been called to do. And we should be very careful about that. Let's go to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. And some of what I'm talking about is not new territory. But it's something that I've thought quite a bit about over the past couple of years, actually. Because this isn't some new thing that's just started. It's been going on for a while, and it's just reached an ugly stage, unfortunately. James chapter 4. James chapter 4. Verses 1 through 4. It says here, why do wars and fights come? Where do wars and fights come from among you? You know, you guys are warring among yourselves. You're biting and devouring each other. Where does that come from? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? We could say, you want your own way. Your will and what you desired was thwarted. So, you're going to go to war over it. So, that's how it comes about in the church, where things break down into conflict, where it's basically selfishness. It's basically selfishness. And, as you look at it, you can reach a point in where you're so convinced of your way, and you want your way to the point where you don't care if the church divides. You don't care what damage it does to the people. You don't care. And sadly, I don't think I'd be real careful about reaching that point. He goes on to say, you lust and do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. And I don't believe that they were literally killing each other. Maybe they were. I don't think so. But they were murdering each other, at least with their words. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You know, you're not going to the right source for what you need. You're not going to the right source for what you really need. He says, you do not receive, you ask and do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. It's being selfish. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So, as we you know, as you look at what's transpiring here, you have a conflict that's taking place. And who's right and who's wrong? I don't know. I don't know. And but you know, if you start digging around for information on this, and I'm certainly not advocating that you do that. I'm advocating you don't. It doesn't help you. Because all these things that I'm telling you and talking about today, when I mow my lawn, I'm thinking about it. When I'm on the airplane flying to Houston, I'm thinking about it. While I'm in Houston, I'm thinking about it. When I get back from Houston, I'm thinking about it. And it's a burden you carry. I don't want burdens. You know, I basically want, bliss all the time. But that's not how life is. That's part and parcel to being a Christian, that sometimes you do have to think about things and try to sort them out and figure out what's the right way to go. That's just how it is. But we are biting and devouring each other. You can go to various places that talk about the crisis in the United Church of God, and you can see this and that, and posting this letter and replies to this letter and all of that. Well, when you're on there, you tell me who's right. Because as you read through it, everybody sounds right. Everybody's got their side of the story, and you don't know, and you aren't going to, and it's very difficult to figure it out. And you can pick sides. But you know, when you post things that accuse, that disparage, and undermine, when you send out emails that attack and accuse, you have a war of words going. You have people lining up on each side of the conflict, and you may be saying, well, what conflict, and whose side are we supposed to be on? Okay, I'm just telling you because, you know, when you, like last week, Mr. Luker spoke, and he thought about, you know, he said, if you don't like it, leave in peace. You're like, well, who's leaving, and why would they leave? Okay, so obviously something's going on. So you have basically a war within the organization, and a war which threatens the organization and threatens God's people within that organization. And in this warfare, this biting and devouring, we see lawlessness. And as you see it play out, it undermines the love that we have for one another as God's people. And sadly, I see good people on both sides who have taken hardened positions. I know. In talking about this, there's a group that's on one side, there's a group that's on the other, and there's a third group that's not on either side. So I'm trying to stay in the third group. That's not on either side. And I see good people on either side. And, you know, they give me their points of view and this and that. And basically, I don't want you know, okay, I hear your point of view, but you show me what justification we have for going off in another direction. I don't think we have one. So, you know, as people look at this kind of thing, you wouldn't, like I said, you wouldn't expect this in the church, would you? I wouldn't. But it's the reality of where the church is. You know, and we're talking about an organization, and you know, it's if Christian, you know, as you look at this, it's very disillusioning. Because you think, well, if Christianity is the real deal, if it's the real deal, and the people of this organization are God's people, how can they act like this? Wouldn't that be a question that might go across through your mind? Or you may think about, well, why be a part of an organization like this that's all filled with dispute and conflict? And that's not everywhere. I'm just telling you that it's out there. Are there any who are true? You know, you might question, well, are there any really truly converted and yielded people? Are there any people out there like that? Oh, I think there are. I know there are. You might think about just the most fundamental thing is, does God's way really work? Does it really work? Where is it working? And where are the fruits of the Spirit being manifested? They are, but sometimes you have to look for them. So when you see these kinds of things going on, we can begin to doubt. We can become discouraged. You know, we can just say, well, I don't need this, and give up. And come to the conclusion, what's the use, and just quit. I'm better off just sitting at home and not putting up with all this nonsense. And we can conclude, as many already have, that an organization is the problem. It's the organization. But that's not the problem. Organizations are, you know, just a grouping of human beings. And an organization makes choices. The people within that organization make those choices, and you can do good or you can not do so good, but it's a choice. So the organization isn't the problem. The pooling of talents and resources, the pooling of God's people coming together, working together, is a good thing. But, unfortunately, we as human beings don't always do what we should. Some people may say, well, it's your form of government. Well, I would venture to say that that's not the problem. Governance isn't the problem. If you're a Christian, you can live under a king, you can live under a dictator, you can live under anything. It doesn't matter what it is. You can live in Russia, you can live in the United States, you can live in a totalitarian state, you can live any place. Because the form of governance isn't the issue. It's how you live and conduct yourself within that form of governance. So the problem is the human nature under Satan's influence. And if we follow human nature with Satan as our counselor, we won't survive. You can't get through the valley of death. You'll never make it. So if you're going to follow carnal nature and think you're going to follow Christ on to the end of this and through this, you'll never make it. So how do we survive the valley of death? So we're here in the valley of death, and we should get through this. So how do we get to the other side? How do we get out of it? Let's go to Psalm 23. Psalm 23. And I think it's always been a reassuring psalm to people, and it still is, and is a psalm we can look to and think, this is quite reassuring. As you look at Psalm 23, it says in verse 1, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." So is the Lord your shepherd? Is the Lord your shepherd? And is He the one who provides those things that you need? The one that you look to for those things that you need? Is the Lord your shepherd? And we are called His flock. And is He our shepherd? It says in verse 2, "He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters." So Christ leads us to green pastures, the good places where we'll get the nourishment we need. And He leads us to where we can drink water that is pure. It says in verse 3, "He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness." If we follow Him, what path will we follow? We'll be on the path of righteousness. You know, last week it talked about Christ as the head of the church. Yes, He is. He's also the great shepherd of the church. And He leads us in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. He's made a promise that He would see us through, and He will do so. Verse 4 says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." Yep, here we are in the valley of the shadow of death. And what does He say? "I will fear no evil." I will fear no evil. Why? Because He says, "You are with me." You, the great shepherd, are with me. And your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So the great shepherd is there with us, and he's with us even through the valley of the shadow of death. And so we don't have to fear evil. We don't have to fear Satan. He's there with us, and He will guide us through. If we're willing to be guided, He will guide us through it. He will watch out for us and protect us. And sometimes we may stray off the trail, and what does He do? He taps you back on, nope, don't go over there. Let's get back on the trail. Let's stay on the right path. And the thing is, as you go through this, you know, as I look at the situation, I think, well, who's right in the dispute? I don't know. But the thing that I do know is that God is the great shepherd and He's with me. And He's there with His rod and His staff and He's guiding me. So the thing is, as I go down this path, I can be reassured that if there's a path to choose, if we come to a fork in the road and there has to be a choice made, that He'll show me what's the right path. Because I want to make the right choice. I want to make the right choice. And He will show me the right choice. It says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over." It says, "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." I'm going to get through whatever I'm facing. And ultimately, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. That's the promise to you and me. And the Good Shepherd is watching us as we go along the path here. And He knows where we're at. He knows what's going on. And He sees what's happening. He's going to see us through to the end. As I said, you know, we have this warfare going on. Should we pick sides? I've mentioned in the past, don't do it. Don't pick sides. Which side should you pick? And once you pick sides, you're gonna advocate for that side. Don't pick sides. Don't do it. You know, if I go to a ball game, I'm gonna pick a team. And I'm gonna root for the team. So, you know, I'm gonna watch an Ohio State game, I'm rooting for Ohio State. I'm not going to be belligerent about it, but I am rooting for them. And once you pick sides, you're for that side. And you begin justifying why that side is right and the other side is wrong. So don't do it, because I don't think you can sort it out. If I can't sort it out, and I know more than you, and I don't know everything. I try to know as little as I can, because I don't want to be sucked into the whole mess. So, you know, what we see is, as we pick sides, it's easy for carnal nature to dictate the direction we'll go. Carnal nature begins to be predominant rather than the Good Shepherd who leads you and guides you. You know, we see terminology used like white hats and black hats. When you begin using terminology like that, you've picked sides. When you use terminology referring to the Council of Elders as the Council of Evil, you've picked sides. You pick sides. When someone is your enemy, it's easy to accuse them, to attack them, to bite and devour. And as you think about it, how do you know that person is not a Christian? And even if they're not, are you to act like that? And if they are Christians in whom God's Spirit dwells, how can you attack them? Even if you disagree. I can say I disagree, but I'm not going to hate you I may even say I think that idea is stupid, but I don't hate you. I think the idea is foolish. You know, if we do disagree, shouldn't we pray for them? Shouldn't we give them the benefit of the doubt until all things are clear? I think we all believe in the sixth commandment, which tells us, "Thou shalt not murder." And as a result of that particular commandment, we don't go to war. We don't take up arms and join the military and go to war. Because God said, "You shall not murder." And if that's the case with literal firearms or other weapons, wouldn't it be the same with a war of words? Can't we murder another person by our disparaging remarks? We can malign them. We can. So if we aren't to murder literally, should we murder figuratively in wars of words? But you know, there is a war going on, so how do you fight the war? How do you fight the war? There is a war going on, so how do you and I fight the war? Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. The Apostle Paul had to fight some wars within the church. You look at the Corinthian church, they had a lot of problems there. Sometimes there were wars that he had to be involved in. But he gives us the right approach in 2 Corinthians 10, beginning in verse 3. He says, "For though we walk in the flesh," we're all flesh and blood. He says, "we do not war according to the flesh." So even though we're flesh and blood, we don't war like flesh and blood would war. We don't take up physical weapons. We don't follow our carnal nature. We do not war according to the flesh. We don't war according to what our human nature under Satan's influence dictates. It says in verse 4, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal." Our weapons are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. You see, your chief resource is God. And it is through God that you pull down strongholds. In your own life, as you deal with sin, and in our lives collectively as an organization or a church. And sometimes we need to collectively pull down a stronghold that exists. And how do we do that? We are mighty in God. He says in verse 5, "casting down arguments." So you have to look at, you know, if you have an argument or a particular discussion that's going on here, we cast down arguments. "And every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God." Anything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, our job is to destroy it, to bring it down. "Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." Every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. So think about that. Is every thought in captivity to, you know, in obedience to Christ? Probably not. Mine aren't. But that's where they should be. That's what we should be striving for. And you see, if we are mighty in God and we take this approach, this is how we war. And if you war in that way, then we'll pull down all of the high things that exalt themselves against God. But that's the way we must war. You can't be following the carnal nature, because there is no benefit or fruit to that. As you get back to Matthew chapter 24, verse 12, talking about the love of God, as we think about our lives, has the love of God waxed cold in us? Has lawlessness that is now manifest in the church caused us to take up arms to justify our attitudes and our words? Hopefully not. So, as we think about how we war, we follow 2 Corinthians 10. And let's go back to James once again, to chapter 4, because it gives us more insight into the approach that we must take. As it talks specifically about disputes that the Apostle James was aware of. James chapter 4. James chapter 4, verse 5. It says, "Or do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells in you yearns jealously?" God's Spirit is in you, and God's Spirit, Christ working in you, is leading you away from this war and disputing, devouring one another. It's leading you in the right direction. And it's trying to pull you in that direction. Verse 6 says, "But He gives more grace, therefore." He says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. You know, if we are prideful, we are arrogant, we are determined to have our own way, God resists that. God resists that. And then interestingly, he goes on to say in verse 7, "Therefore, submit to God." Submit to God. That's how we are mighty. That's how we pull strongholds down. Submit to God. Submit to God. Resist the devil. Satan seeks to influence you. Resist him. And as you submit to God and you resist Satan, it says that he, Satan, will flee from you. He says in verse 8, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. So, you know, if we make an effort to draw near to God, God says, I will draw near to you. I'll be close to you. I'll be there for you. It says, cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. You know, people that are kind of living on the fence, trying to live carnally and spiritually. You know, and these people were in that circumstance. And he said, cleanse your hearts. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. We want to be single-minded in our approach. And he says in verse 9, lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. What does he mean by that? We're supposed to walk around in a haggard fashion, just a little depressed. Is that what he's talking about? Let's go back to Nehemiah, because I'm reading through the Bible, and I reached Nehemiah, and I read this, and in light of what's, you know, the situation that we face now, it just stood out in my mind. And it's interesting what Nehemiah has to say here at the beginning of the book. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. It came to pass in the month Kislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel. So he is living in Shushan, there with the Persian emperor, and he serves the Persian emperor as cupbearer. But he is a Jew. He is a Jew, and as a Jew, he looks to where he came from. He knew that he came from Judea. He knew that that was the center where God was worshipped in Jerusalem, on Mount Zion. He knew that. And he said in verse 2, so he's there, and he says in verse 2, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah. So here comes a party of men back from the land of Judah. And the Jews have been allowed to return. When Cyrus the Great defeated Babylon, he freed the Jews. And he allowed the Jews to go back to their land and to rebuild the temple and rebuild the city. And we'll talk about that more here in a Bible study here in the future. But anyway, he says that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. How are things going? Can you give me an update? How are things going with all those who went back to the land? And they said to me, so he wants good news. He wants a good report that everything is prospering. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. That's not the message he wanted to hear. So what's his reaction? You see, his heart was in God's work. He was concerned about God's people. And he says in verse 4, so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. So what does he do? He's sad, he's mourning, he's lamenting. And he goes to God. He goes to the only source that he can go to. And he admits, I've sinned. my father's house have sinned. And you know, as you look, he's talking about Israel here, but is, you know, as you can think about it, you can put the church in there. He says in verse 7, we have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. We should be living lives of service, lives that reflect what Christ told His disciples before His departure, that His church would be known for the love they have for one another. That's how we should be living. But that's not where we're at. We have acted very corruptly against you. Verse 8, remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. Does that just apply to nations, or does it apply to all of us? Verse 9, but if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest part of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling place for my name. Now these are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. That's all of us. We are the God's people, and we have been redeemed by His great power and His strong hand. And he goes on to say, O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And he goes on to ask that God would give him favor as he went before the ruler of the Persian Empire. And I think it's very applicable to where we're at now. I know Mr. Luker talked about our need to fast, and I think maybe we should. If you haven't yet, I hope that you will. And you might keep these things in mind that Nehemiah had to say. I think they're most applicable. Let's go back to James 4 and just look at a couple other things here before we come to a conclusion here, because James chapter 4, verse 10, as James comes to the conclusion of his thought here about the proper approach, he says in verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of God, and He will lift you up. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. Verse 11 is interesting to me, because he's talking about this fighting and disputing among themselves, and then he talks about the humility and the proper approach and resisting Satan and submitting to God and drawing near to God and cleansing your hands and your hearts and lamenting and mourning and being humble. And then he goes on to say in verse 11, he says, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. You don't think that was taking place in this war that he's discussing? You see, as you humble yourself before God and your heart becomes softened, you don't want to do that. You want to be very careful about that. Final scriptures, final passage. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. The love chapter. You know, we hear it so often, and it's, sometimes it seems, you know, we might think of it as somewhat trite. But sometimes it's only trite, or because we've heard it so many times, it doesn't, we don't stop and think about it. But we should. Chapter 13, verse 1, it says, though I speak with the tongues of men, so I have the ability to speak in all sorts of different languages. And I can even speak in the language of angels. And I can take a lot of pride in that. He says, you know, if I have that ability and I don't have love for God and my fellow man, I have become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. I'm just making noise that has no significance. He says in verse 2, and though I have the gift of prophecy, I have the ability to speak inspired sermons, or I have the ability to reveal mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could move mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If you have power and ability and it's not motivated by love, it really doesn't mean much. You can move mountains? That's pretty amazing. But he said if your motivation in doing that is not love, it's really insignificant. It's really insignificant. He says in verse 3, "And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor." And so I take what I have and I give it to the poor. And he says, "And though I give my body to be burned, but I have not love, it profits me nothing. So I'm willing to sacrifice my life and my goods, but I really don't love." He said it doesn't mean anything. It says in verse 4, "Love suffers long and is kind." You know, as we love one another, frankly, you and I, we're all pains in the butt to one extent or another. And we make each other suffer long sometimes. He's telling you, you know what? Even though they make you suffer, you still should be kind. He says, and love does not envy. You know, love doesn't look at what somebody else has and say, "I want it." Love does not parade itself. You know, it doesn't say, "Look at me, how great I am." Love is not puffed up. It's not prideful and boasting. Does not behave rudely. Love is respectful, courteous. Does not seek its own. It's not love. Love thinks about what's best for everybody here. What's best for everybody? Love is not provoked. It's not something that just is easily provoked and reacts. Thinks no evil. That person who is motivated by love isn't there looking for evil or looking for evil in something. Love does not rejoice in iniquity. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things and believes all things and hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. That's to be our motivating force, and it never fails. But you know, we have to be close to God for that to take place. As we draw nigh to God, He will draw nigh to us. We are mighty in God. We are not mighty in any other thing. So, brethren, it is inevitable that we will walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It's part of our calling. And we are in that valley to one extent or another right now. I don't think it's affected you overly much, but from time to time you will hear things and probably wonder, well, what in the world's going on? I wonder the same thing. Satan is our chief adversary, and he brings both external and internal threats our way in order to destroy us. But we have the whole armor of God, so we can take the field and we can stand. And with God's help, we can overcome him. Satan wants lawlessness to abound in the world, and he wants it to abound in the church, especially in the church, because if he can cause it to abound there and cause the love of many to wax cold, he's achieved his purpose. Our love will not wax cold, but be perfected as we humble ourselves before God, as we resist the devil and his influences. As we draw near to God, he will draw near to us, and he will lead us out of all of this, and whatever else we have to face along the way. We have the Good Shepherd, with his rod and his staff guiding us. And as we move off the path and we have God's Spirit in us, and we're attentive to God's Spirit, it'll bring us back to where we need to be. So we are in a tough time now in the Church of God, and we are in a sense in the valley of the shadow of death, but we have no need to fear evil. Because God, Christ's rod and staff are there to comfort us. And once we get through these times, and the challenging times that we face ahead, we can always be reassured that ultimately, as we get through these things, we will dwell in the house of God forever. (Clears throat)